The following talk was given by Steve Hagen at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on September 10, 2014. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
What I had in mind originally for this kickoff night was I was going to show some cartoons from the New Yorker, which I've done before. There's some real Dharma teaching in New Yorker cartoons. Did you know that? And there's some real gems in there. And I've done this before, but we didn't have this set up. So when I did this, it was some years ago now, but I've just holed up the little cartoons. People couldn't really see them all that well, but no. You see, I could project them on the screen. That's what I thought I would do. Till I happened to mention it to Scott, many of you know, my agent, my literary agent, and he let me know right away that, well, that's copyrighted material, and I wouldn't be able to do that, you see. Years ago, when I was studying with Katagiri, and I, over at the Minnesota Zen Center, and I had drawn up a four-panel cartoon that I was thinking of publishing there in their newsletter or whatever, but I never got around to doing that. But I had this thing sketched out. Actually, I came upon it some weeks ago. I don't know, you know, and I know I can't find it again. But I was thinking I could just use that little sketch that I had and give a little presentation, something that I had wanted to do for years, but couldn't find it. So I ended up redrawing the darn thing. I don't think my current drawings are as good as what I had sketched out some years ago, but it's easy for me to say that just as an excuse that I really can draw better than what you're going to see here. But anyway, so I redrew this four-panel thing because I guess I own the copyright on it, right? So, but as I start to present it to you, I'll let you know as to why I did this in the first place. It'll kind of come out. So, Lao Tzu, you know about Lao Tzu? Great wise teacher. Some people think of him as the founder of Taoism. Probably he was mythical, but there really wasn't any Lao Tzu. But Jose, why don't you show us the first slide? And here's Lao Tzu as a baby. Lao Tzu is a baby. He doesn't know that he doesn't know. And I wanted to show you this first slide because you see, well, there he is. He has a little beard. The myth, the story is that Lao Tzu was so wise that he stayed in his mother's womb for 65 years before he was born. And then when he was born, he had this long gray beard. You can imagine after. Yeah, you'd think so by that time, wouldn't you? Yeah. Well, of course, I think that that's nonsense, you know, so I just gave him a little beard here rather than this long gray beard. But this Lao Tzu is a baby. Doesn't know that he doesn't know. The reason I got onto this, well, why don't you show us the next slide here. Lao Tzu is a teenager. He knows that he knows. This was years ago when I did that first sketch. And my stepson, Dan, was a teenager at the time. He's now a grown man with children of his own. But at the time when I first got this inspiration to do this four-panel slide here that you're going to see, I got it from Dan, actually, as a teenager. So I imagine that was so many years ago now, it's hard to remember exactly what occurred that evening. But I mean, I was up in my study working. I was working on my first book. Anyway, Dan came up and we were talking about whatever. And I think at some point I pointed out to Dan that Socrates, the great wise Greek philosopher, Socrates, who probably did live. But Socrates said, I know that I don't know. And who was it? The Oracle of Delphi, was it? Who called Socrates the wisest of all men because he knew that he didn't know. So that was his great wisdom, Socrates. Well, I must have told this to Dan. Somehow we must have been talking about this. Anyway, he left. He went down to his room, whatever, and I went back to whatever I was doing. And a little while later, pretty soon, Dan just comes barging in, and he says, "I know that I know." And, you know, as a teenager, and just thinking, hey, well, so he thought that that was pretty great. Well, a very typical teenage kind of approach. Well, when he said that, this four-panel show I'm going to give you here came to my mind all at once. Suddenly I realized these four stages of life. It doesn't quite match with Lao Tzu's image of him being born at the age of 65, but Lao Tzu is a baby. He doesn't know that he doesn't know. But as a teenager, he knows that he knows, right? Here's Lao Tzu in middle age. He knows that he doesn't know. And you see, he's been reading his Plato here, his Socrates, and Lao Tzu in middle age. He knows that he doesn't know. Well, the reason all of this came to me in a flash was because if you go to the final slide here, you have Lao Tzu in old age. He said, "I don't know that I know." So Lao Tzu in old age, he doesn't know that he knows. So we have the four, right? I want to say a little bit about, why don't you go to the final slide. This was the panel that I had drawn, the four-panel shot here. But I want to take a look at these two. And here we have, really, the statements by Socrates. You know, Socrates knows that he doesn't know. Lao Tzu, he said he doesn't know that he knows. When I first encountered this, many years before I talked to Dan about this, well, the Socrates one, it made sense to me right away, and I thought, boy, that's pretty cool. You know, I could see how the Oracle of Delphi would consider him the wisest of all men. He knows that he doesn't know. When I encountered later on, though I was still fairly young myself, probably in my 20s, when I encountered this statement here, Lao Tzu doesn't know that he knows. That one really struck me, but it also puzzled me, and I couldn't understand it really, but I could feel that there was something profound, very deep, about that way of looking at this matter of knowledge, this matter of wisdom. We don't have an oracle to tell us about Lao Tzu. Is Socrates really the wisest of all men, of all people, because he knows that he doesn't know? What about Lao Tzu, who doesn't know that he knows? I want to give this to you because you can contemplate this or think about this when you go away tonight. Carry it with you for a while, maybe some years even, if you can. I did anyway. Until I finally understood the difference, after also wondering if, are these just two ways of saying the same thing? Or is there a distinction here? And I think we could say, and this isn't to put one or the other down, but this would be kind of a, perhaps a Western way of engaging this question of knowledge. What do I know? This would be an Eastern approach, perhaps. But what exactly is the difference here? Well, he knows. Here we have, perhaps we should call this now Socrates, I don't know. But he knows that he doesn't know. Which, when we consider our usual approach to life, we might question or wonder or maybe have a sense or feeling of what it is that we know or what kind of body of knowledge we might have or possess our learning in life. And we might think of life as we go on through life, we acquire more knowledge and more skill perhaps, more know-how all of this, but just general knowledge about the world and about ourselves. And maybe with enough of this, we might start to realize that actually, you know, I don't know. I don't know what's going on here. I don't understand. And this was Socrates' way of going about the world, always asking the questions, you know, the Socratic method, always probing, digging, asking questions, asking that of his students. But the students would think, oh, I know this, I understand this. And he'd ask questions about that. Kind of a Nagarjunian approach, in a way. Nagarjuna, who in his Mulambajamaka Karika, you remember, always asking or examining this, examining that, different things that we think we know, that we understand about the self, that we understand about the Four Noble Truths or the Buddha's teaching, or about conditions, or about time, or about the self. All of these different things, and Nagarjuna would have us examine these things. Very much in, say, in the way that Socrates would approach things. But Socrates got to a point where he realized, he understood, he knew that he didn't know. Nagarjuna can bring us to that same point as well, where you can know conceptually that you actually can't know ultimately reality by holding to it conceptually. We can actually come to realize this and understand this about ourselves just by probing our own minds, by testing, questioning what it is that we think we understand and what it is that we think we know. But all the while, this is working with conceptual knowledge, which is what most of us probably live out our lives thinking, well, yeah, well, that's what knowledge is. All knowledge is conceptual. It must be conceptual, right? If this is the case, perhaps we don't even really think about it at all. Maybe you've never thought about this. But if we do begin to question what it is that we know or that what we think about one thing or another, we're going to be engaging just our conceptual thought and having questions about that. And if we do that, if we pursue that enough, this is what Nagarjuna invites us to do, and it is what Socrates no doubt did to arrive finally at the understanding that, like in the case of Socrates, that he knows that he doesn't know. Did Nagarjuna leave us with that? Nowhere does Nagarjuna ever make a statement quite like that. He just uses a very similar method of probing and testing, questioning, examining whatever it is that we think. When I give the classes on Nagarjuna, the students, they stop doing this. I haven't taught this class now for a while, so maybe there'll be enough fresh students in here who might start asking the same question. Except I'm going to give it away to all of you if you haven't taken that course, in case you do take it again, or take it when I offer it again. But students at some point, usually this is a year-long class, and usually 6, 8, 10 weeks into the class, and they want to know, well, what's Nagarjuna's point? What does he want us to know? What is the truth? Because Nagarjuna keeps showing us that you think this, and he'll show you this is contradictory, this is faulty. You think that, you know? And he points out that this doesn't hold up. And he does this over and over and over again. Until probably in our minds, we might get pushed past this point where Socrates is. Maybe we don't yet know that we don't know, but we're getting suspicious that whatever it is I think. As our teacher said, Kagiri Roshi, he said point blank one day, blurted out right in the middle of a lecture, he said, whatever you think, it's delusion. It's right out of Nagarjuna. Okay, so then what are we supposed to think? We might think something like that. If we really didn't hear what, in that instance, Katagiri Roshi said, that whatever you think is delusion. And Nagarjuna, he doesn't he doesn't go as far. He didn't spell that out. All he does is just, he doesn't bother with that. He just keeps pointing out that you probably think this, you think that, you think the next thing, and he'll just show you that this doesn't hold up. And so we're left grasping. We want to know. Well, what this approach to helping us come to realize what it is that we think, what it is that we think we know, what it is that we think we understand, by probing this in these various ways, we might come to realize all conceptual knowledge is like this. Ultimately, it's contradictory, it doesn't hold up. But in understanding this, we might start to realize, well, not start, probably in a flash, you might realize that actually that isn't the only kind of knowledge. Actually, what I would say now, I thought that way for a while, but I realize now that that actually isn't even knowledge at all. What it is that we think we know conceptually, that's not even really knowledge. What it is that we know, what we truly know, and we've known it all along, we've known from the start, you can't help but know this, is actual truth and reality itself. So we could look at a statement like Lao Tzu here in old age, going past this, not expecting to have conceptual knowledge of this that he doesn't know, that he can't know, which is conceptual knowledge, that isn't knowledge. We can come to realize we don't know, we don't hang on to conceptual knowledge, thinking that somehow this will ever get us to actual, true knowledge. So in other words, we can look at it like this. Lao Tzu saying he doesn't have any ideas about what it is that he knows. That's another way we could read that. Are you following me on this so far? So this is really quite profound knowledge. This not knowing, not having conceptual, not being, you might have ideas or whatever, but not being caught up, not holding to conceptual constructs that we might have, looking for and expecting knowledge to be found in that. We set this aside. We don't hang on to that kind of knowledge, which, as I just mentioned, isn't really knowledge at all. If we see that and we can set that aside, what is left is actually what we truly do know. And this is awakening. This is a profound understanding. It is not being confused by the actual lives that we're living. It is true knowledge. So, as Lao Tzu put it here, pretty good, even though he's a mythical guy, so who knows where this came from. But there we have this teaching. He doesn't know that he knows. He doesn't have a conceptual construct for what it is that he knows. And this is not something mysterious to you. And I'll give you an example here in just a minute. This might seem like something very abstract, very far away, kind of like, whoa. We're talking about the everyday here. And I've used this example many times. And those of you who heard me, you'll right away, maybe some of you now even know where I'm going to go with this in just a moment. But if you've never heard me talk on this before, it doesn't matter. I'm going to give this example. And it's very simple and very direct, and you will understand it, I think. Though you might not feel that, well, it's not that profound. Actually, this is quite profound. The kind of knowledge we're talking about is like the knowledge of knowing the taste of orange juice, knowing the taste of the strawberry. This is not open to conjecture. It is not something to speculate on. It is not something to even have ideas about. Well, you could have ideas about it, I suppose. But what kind of nonsense is that? You cannot put it into a conceptual form, at least not one that would convey to someone else who's never tasted orange juice the taste of orange juice. But you know it, and you know it completely and directly, and there isn't anything that anybody could do to convince you that actually you don't know it. Well, maybe there are some things. I can give you some things that might hang it up for you. But actually, if we go further with it, you'll see that you do know this. You could think, well, what if I just ate a mint? Now I'm tasting orange juice. Would I really know the taste of orange juice? Because I'd have this other flavor in my mouth distorting it. Okay. And see, our conceptual minds will try to find examples like this and argue with it, you know, and to cloud the issue. But the point about this is, even if I say the taste of orange juice, just in even talking that way, is using concepts and things like this that muddle the picture. The point I'm making there is that if there is this taste, we could say it's orange. I'm just saying that to give you an example. But it doesn't matter if you've just eaten a mint or not. There's that taste. You can say, well, that's not really the taste. Never mind. There's that taste. That is what you know. We don't have to call it orange juice. We can call it orange mint or something like this. I don't know. But in the end, you can get rid of all of that. Wordlessly, you know this immediately. The aroma of coffee or something like this. It is immediate, it is direct, and it is known. And in just this same way, you already know reality. You already know the truth. You know Dharma. But it never strikes us as anything consequential or important or something, you know, I should be paying attention to. Nor do we even have a realization that this is actually reality that's being experienced directly. Before we say anything to our mind, before we slap labels on it, before we compare, before we discuss, we're already having a true, direct, immediate experience of reality right from the very start. So this is what Lao Tzu, I think, is expressing here when he says, I don't know that I know. I don't have ideas about what it is that I know. I can't tell you the taste of orange juice or whatever it is that I'm tasting now or smelling now or thinking now or feeling now. I can't say. If I tell you right now I have an ache in my knee, you know, and you could relate to that perhaps because maybe you've had an ache in your knee, if not maybe your elbow, or at least you've had an ache probably, so you have a rough idea. But you don't know what I'm experiencing. That's just a concept, an idea that's been tossed about. It might give you some ideas and maybe make you sympathetic with me or whatever. I, at the moment, I don't have an ache in my knee, but do you see what I'm saying here, what I'm getting at? So this is a pretty subtle understanding here, that he doesn't know that he knows. Okay? Because that knowledge, the knowledge that he knows, isn't expressible in words. But it is known. And this is what it was that the Buddha awakened to. That Nagarjuna did. Or Dogen. When Dogen will say things like, grasses and trees are mind. I tell you that and it startles your ears. Because conceptually, grasses and trees are mind. But what is it that we know directly? That is mind. What do you want to call it? There's sound, there's color, there's flavor, there's thought, there's feeling. But we think that the feeling or the thought or the flavor or the color or whatever wraps around something. And something then owns those qualities. And that's the conceptual, that's the nugget, that's where it's, you know, and then we get knowledge and ideas about that, and we can arrange them in various ways, and we think that this is actual knowledge. Well, it's a knowledge of a sort, it's conceptual knowledge. But being caught up in the conceptual, to the extent that we're totally caught up in there, we easily remain oblivious to what it is that we actually know. To the extent that we really step into a full, direct realization of what it is that we know, this is awakening itself. And there's no confusion in it. Everything else in our constructed reality will seem maybe somewhat dreamlike or whatever, but still real. We can't dismiss it. So this is also important to understand. Well, maybe I've said enough here, though, for tonight. But any questions or arguments or contraries to what I've pointed out here?
There's another way to interpret that. Not too analytic.
Oh, I'm sure, yeah. Yeah, what would that be?
Senility.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty good. I like that. Yeah. Yeah. It's true. Yeah, yeah, you could interpret it that way. That's why very yeah.
But does he know that?
But does he know? Right. Good point. But see, to interpret it that way, we're still left completely inside the conceptual. Yeah. But that is one way, and for this very reason, very often we find in our teachings these examples of where the wise person often looks like the fool. They seem like a fool, like a dunce. You know, they sit there like a lump of wood or something, as if no feeling, no understanding, nothing taking place here with, you know. So we have these kinds of images that are used and tossed about, but we shouldn't make the mistake of thinking that actually, you know, we have the stone sitting, and this is a Buddha just sitting like a stone, full patience, calmness. We might think, but there's nothing in the mind of that Buddha, you know. Is there knowledge there? No. Yeah, so when we keep things in the conceptual, we'll have these kinds of questions and concerns. But in spite of that, what it was, at least I attempted to point out here and interpret that saying in that way, that's really not what this is getting at. And as I also mentioned when I first came upon this, and I said I pondered it for years, really, and I often waited against this thing here. And then when Dan spoke that time, suddenly I just saw the whole thing in terms of like a quadrilemma or something, which I thought was kind of funny. But after years of contemplating this and looking at it, at some point you see that what's being said here is not like our ordinary knowledge. It's not conceptual knowledge at all. So we would cheapen it and shortchange ourselves if we interpret this as, well, that must mean that he's senile, you know. But I agree. It fits perfectly. That's why the wise man often is likened to a dunce, you know. Yeah, did you have something, Antonia?
Well, I had a sister with special needs, and as I observe children of friends who have special needs, it immediately brings Annie to my mind, this great confidence. He doesn't know that he knows. They move forward with faith and determination, and they're aware that they don't know knowledge around them. It was very hard on her, but she still had the sense of being to move forward.
Yeah, and because she does know.
Yeah, and she, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it didn't get her down because of that.
Yeah. So she didn't have to be so hung up in the conceptual realm as the rest of us are, you know.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a freedom in that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was wonderful.
Mm-hmm. All things are of this knowledge. We can't escape it.
she was very real.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm sure she was, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's also like with little children, too. They're not so cluttered up with a lot of ideas yet. But eventually they'll get all warped and messed up like the rest of us, you know. But we can continue on. We don't have to stop in this warped place. We can go on. He was like here, passing through this, he knows that he's still locked in the conceptual here. And he realizes, man, I don't know anything anymore. And we can get to that point. And then with the Socratic story, it seems like maybe this is kind of the end of the line, but that's real knowledge when you finally realize that, you know, you're not hanging on to it at all. But we can go past that. We can go further than that and realize, you know, that stuff that we were hanging on, that's not even actual knowledge. That's belief, speculation, conjecture. It's all of those kind of things, hypotheses. But it's not actual knowledge. We have to break through, break out of, well, we can't really break out of, but the world of the conceptual. We actually can't leave it. But we don't have to be fooled by it. And so you're describing perhaps somebody who hadn't gotten so embedded in it and caught up in it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's kind of a freedom there. We break through, and in some ways then too, we can look like the simplistic fool or the child or whatever, but actually have full wisdom here, mm-hmm. You know. But most of us never get through this dense place where it's all a mess and we're hanging on. We're trying to sort it and make it all, arrange it just so we have it right. I want to know the real. And Nagarjuna will show you can't arrange it anyway, so it'll be right. He shows this to us. And then, of course, if we're still here, we'll think, oh, well, then there's no hope. Yeah, well, no, but you can keep going. And that's what this practice is that we do. This is what our teachings point to. They direct our attention to something as profound as this, and as simple and direct as this. And as my teacher also said, Kage Roshi, that the truth is very simple, reality is very simple, but our minds are complex, and we make everything complex, you know. Children, you know, and people perhaps with certain disabilities, they haven't developed yet that complexity or whatever, with the entanglements of the grasping of the various notions and things. But sooner or later they will. And it seems, I guess, I think we have to go through that. Though most of us end up getting pretty stuck. But I'm here to say at least that doesn't have to be the end of the line. We can go on. So, and our time is up. So, but thank you. And thank you all.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.